This is the fourth day of this March 2014 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from the written teachings of 14th century Japanese Zen master Musō Kokushi. And this is from a book called Dream Conversations on Buddhism and Zen, translated by Thomas Cleary. These are written replies to questions from a very prominent official in Japan at the time, the brother of the shogun. We left off yesterday talking about how complex our causes and cause and effect in terms of different time, the seeds of causation sprout and then now he switches to a very short one here. If you forget your feelings about things of the world, they become enlightening teachings. If you get emotional about enlightening teachings, it becomes a worldly thing. So, an example. Let's see. If you forget your feelings about things of the world, they become enlightening teachings. So, just drawing from a current events with the Russian annexation of Crimea, if we respond to that on a feeling level, for example, anger, indignation, then they can just become something. If we forget, let's say, if we forget our don't go there. If we don't indulge in anger, let's say, about something like that, then we can see it with a dispassion that enables us to see the Dharma. Enlightening teachings means the Dharma revealed. And in that situation, what we see is, of course, first of all, change, impermanence, that there's nothing we can rely on, which is what one of the points he made in what we read from yesterday's Teisho. There's nothing we can be absolutely secure about. Intimately related to the teaching of impermanence is that of no self. There's no fixed self nature to Russia. For 20 years, they can be, the Russian bear can be docile and then suddenly change, just as people can change. There's no fixed self to any of us or to aggregates of us in form of nations. I don't think he would suggest that we passively accept anything that happens, but that if we don't allow ourselves to reflexively get emotional about things that happen, bad things or good things, then we can see right there the teachings. Oh, then of course the third one. I'm drawing here from the three characteristics of existence. This is one of the basic tenets of Buddhist teaching, is that these are the characteristics of existence are impermanence, no self, and suffering. And then you see certainly the suffering involved in this particular geopolitical event, and the even worse, the potential suffering that will come from it in a chain of events. So if we can forget our feelings about things of the world, they become enlightening teachings. And then on the other hand, if we get emotional about enlightening teaching, it becomes a worldly thing. So, enlightening teaching, how about the four vows? No, let's do the four... suffering, cause of suffering... Thank you. Four noble truths. Please, don't tell anyone. the Four Noble Truths. Of course, those truths. So there too, I suppose you could get emotional about it. The first one, suffering, and then the second, the cause of suffering is egoistic craving and delusion, and oh my God, and then it's just something worldly, as he would say. And we can play this out in all kinds of aspects of Buddhist teaching and Zen teaching. We can romanticize them. We can leaving us feeling grim and pessimistic and unrealistically optimistic. But then we just change the teaching, this enlightening teaching, to something else. We kind of contaminate it with our own emotional reactions, because there's no reason to romanticize anything about the teaching. It's very simple. It's, as we said yesterday, it's more like science. Things are what they are. When Lin Chi was asked about the Dharma, he said, "When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep." After washing our hands, we dry them. In the Mumon Khan, Mumon, in one verse, says, "Rain falls and the earth gets wet." If this sounds flat and dry, it's because you don't see the exquisite completeness of it, the wondrous nature of it. When we do, then things in their plainness, in their most ordinary their most ordinariness, are marvelous. They're a marvel. And we don't need to paint the lily with more emotionality about it. It's, of course, there are times when we will have emotional reactions to things. Joy, but then not to cling to those things by dwelling on whatever it was that prompted us to get emotional. Now, the next one, he talks about virtue and how deceptive it can be. Doing good, seeking rewards, is contaminated virtue. Doing good without thought of reward, dedicating it to enlightenment, is uncontaminated virtue. Contamination and non-contamination refer to the state of mind of the doer, not to the good deed itself. So if we are, let's say, generous, but are attached to our generosity, thinking even more, in a very subtle way, how good we are in our generosity, then that's contaminated virtue. But if we do things that are considered good, virtuous, with no trace of thought of getting anything from it, this is the real thing, the pure thing. And then this phrase, dedicating it to enlightenment, well, this is what we do in our chanting. When we say, faith in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha brings true liberation, we now return the merit of our chanting to, and then we say, Shakyamuni Buddha and the three bodhisattvas. This is a form of doing what he's referring to here. And in all things, really, in Zen, the act itself it can't be meritorious or non-meritorious. It's the mind state behind it. Next entry here. There is a vast potential latent within human beings that remains undiscovered because of the limitations placed on consciousness by habitual preoccupations. The recommendation that all cravings be relinquished does not mean that detachment itself is a goal. It is a means of breaking through self-imposed restrictions and opening up this inexhaustible treasury of potential. So it's not that our cravings for food or sex or sleep or any other one, basic ones, that these we should make them a goal in themselves, but that by exercising moderation in these things, we are able to open up, access this great reservoir of energy and insight in us. So, with regard to sleep, for example, it's not that going with as little sleep as possible has some inherent virtue in it, but rather by spending more of our nights, the nighttime hours, doing zazen instead of sleeping, has the potential to really open things up in our practice. I think this is he's pointing to a misunderstanding that a lot of people, in not just in Zen but other spiritual traditions, can get into, which is that there's something holy about depriving ourselves of pleasures. It's not that. It's just that it's a way to access this mind that is common to all of us, this true mind. This phrase, he's talking about this potential we have, this true nature that remains undiscovered because of the limitations placed on the mind by habitual preoccupations. Habitual preoccupations. This is what we have in our faces during sesshin. This mind of habitual self-concerns. This blocks us. This binds us to suffering. This preoccupation with our stories, our neuroses, which really, a neurosis really comes down to habit force, habit energy, mental habit energy. And then here another one. Just as greed for worldly things is inhibiting and self-defeating, so also craving for other worldly things prevents the opening of the mind. So he doesn't let anyone off the hook here, that those of us in spiritual practice can get into, get attached to wanting to have special experiences in our meditation, and craving them, peak experiences, or enlightenment itself. Craving enlightenment is another obstacle. Psychic powers, this is not very common, but at least I don't hear much about it in Zen, but there are those who become become fascinated by paranormal powers, and this becomes their main interest. But in Zen, we don't have much truck with those things. Why? Because they don't really bring an end to suffering. Developing psychic powers does not help us reduce suffering. Something so wonderfully focused about Buddhist practice. The Buddha once said, "I teach but two things: suffering and the end of suffering." And really, this whole practice is designed to help us get beyond suffering. And what doesn't help that is something extraneous and not anything we want to waste time with. When people are unsympathetic to you and the world does not go as you wish, this should be a help to detachment of feelings from the repetitious cycle of becoming and decay, gaining and losing. So he pretty much lays this out in a pretty plain way. And when we're facing adversity, this can be a way of reminding us of how ultimately our worldly pursuits are not going to bring us out of suffering. This is the upside of losses that we suffer, is that they are reminders. They show us the way, potentially, if we can respond to them that way. The withholding of divine aid from those who would become presumptuous, more attached, more indulgent, and more shameless if their wishes were fulfilled is itself divine aid to such people. So, such people who are presumptuous, indulgent, shameless, for them to, let's say, pray, and have their prayers answered for whatever their self-interested desires are, would not help them. So having them denied, having those prayers denied, is a form of help to such people. And he just says, in a corrupt age, when prayers are not answered, that is itself the answer. So remember, these are replies to this prominent official, brother of the shogun. And so perhaps he raised some question about if I pray to have my treasury replenished, can I count on that? And then this is an answer. Next one, the pity that great sages have for ordinary people is not necessarily because of the wretchedness of the human condition in itself, but more because of the great potential humanity has and does not use, the high estate from which humanity has fallen. So it's in contrast to our potential that we can feel pity, compassion at least, not because of the wretchedness of our condition in itself. It's how we don't use this limited time that we have on this earth in a way that can lead to liberation. People can be in quite wretched conditions, but with a mind that seeks the way, this need not be an obstacle. The central benefit of Zen in the context of the ordinary ups and downs of life is not in preventing the minus and promoting the plus, but in directing people to the fundamental reality that is not under the sway of ups and downs. There's a nice little story told few times before about the king, the Indian king, who went to the royal jeweler and said, "I want you to take this ring and engrave on it some words of wisdom, some words that will support me in times of misfortune and restrain me in times of fortune." He said, "I'll be back in a week and to see what you've done." So a week later, he came back with his horses and men and asked the jeweler, "Do you have the ring?" "Yes, sire, I do." "Well, may I see it then?" So he hands him the ring, and the king reads on the ring, engraved there, "It will pass." This is a great little mantra that we can pull out of our pocket during sesshin, whether things are going well or things are going poorly. Just remind yourself, it'll pass. That'll help us remain centered when things are going great for us and we're starting to get excited. It will pass. And it works when we're dejected, feeling discouraged. It works if we could just take this to heart, it will pass, then we wouldn't get trapped in states of mind, which are really possibly the most formidable handicap in Sesshin, is getting caught in states of mind and not realizing that we're in them, and just losing ourselves in the difficulty or the way that when things are going well. And that's a good segue, actually, into talking about Makkyo. There are a couple segments here where he talks about demons. Demons is, I see, is just an old word from ancient times, in 14th century times. A demon was a word they would use for that we would render today in contemporary language more as obstructions, traps, and among obstructions and traps and are Makkyo. But let's let him start this off. There are various mental phenomena and mental postures that obstruct the potential for true understanding. Because of their harmful and destructive nature, they are called demons or devils. And then he starts off with states of mind that we can get lodged in. These demons include greed, hatred, conceit, opinionated views, addiction to meditation states, pride in knowledge, desire for personal liberation for one's own sake alone, sentimental compassion, anxious haste to attain enlightenment, idolizing teachers, rejecting the teaching because of finding fault with teacher's behavior, indulging in passions, and fearing passion. Usually and conventionally, when we speak of Makkyo in Zen, we mean, well, broadly speaking, any of the side effects of Zazen, intense Zazen, sitting hours and hours a day. There are side effects, unusual body-mind phenomena that come up. But in the broader sense, those can include these different states of mind, states of anger, of remorse, of sorrow, of fear, anxiety. These are the kinds of states that can roll in on us when we're getting deeper in our practice. So they're not a bad sign entirely, because they usually don't happen when we're just doing rather superficial Zazen. We're not likely to run into those things. What has been called Bonpu Zen, the Japanese call Bonpu Zen, which is Zen, doing Zen practice just for relaxation and simple mentally stabilizing things or physical health. Eiken Roshi somewhere defines Bonpu Zen as safe, uneventful Zazen. That should be humbling to a lot of people who do Zen practice just as a kind of a cocktail to relax at the end of a day, or just to feel more collected. Well, it's fine if that's all you want, is to be more integrated, centered, grounded, calm. Those are wonderful benefits. But they're so much less than what's possible through this practice. So if we're doing that kind of sitting, then we're not likely to run into any storms and problems. But in Sesshin, it's hard to sit with such a limited way. We find ourselves getting deeper into our practice, and then these different side effects can come up. Of course, it also means hallucinations, visual hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, tactile hallucinations. I just heard from someone in Doksan about suddenly feeling that half of his face was going, getting paralyzed. And he suddenly thought, oh my God, is this Bell's palsy? Am I... And wouldn't you know, half an hour later, it was gone. We have to be alert and vigilant and mindful that when these peculiar sensations or states of mind come up, we have to be able to have the mindfulness to recognize them as makyo, as side effects, and to also remember that they pass. They all pass. Makyo all pass. They're just transitory states, transitory sensations and mental states, emotional states. Because if we tumble into these without any awareness of what's going on, then they can really hijack us. He continues, these demons may arise because of incorrect application of mind. They may also flare up in a correctly applied mind in which they are about to die out, just as a candle flame will flare up just before it goes out. So this is another condition ripe for the arising of makyo, is when the mind is becoming very quiet, very still, and it's a kind of a way for the mind to kick back, fight back, and somehow derail us from that state. I once heard of a term used in politics called the sunset effect. I think it was many years ago, where a very conservative politician was elected at a time when many people thought that extreme conservatism was on its way out. And the hopeful pronouncement at the time by someone was, well, this could just be the sunset effect, where the sun, right before it goes under the horizon, has its most spectacular presentation. It's colors, forms. Well, this, I think, is not dissimilar from the way we can find ourselves swept into a makyo, where we really are settling more into a deeper state, and that's when these side effects can happen. And then he just says, in any case, do not allow the mind to be stirred by demons, because this agitation perpetuates their influence. Here's another thing about Makya. A simple method of quelling demons is to refrain from clinging to anything mentally. This is illustrated by an ancient story in which a strange person used to roam around the grounds of a hermitage of a certain meditation master. Sometimes he would appear as a Buddhist saint, sometimes as a celestial king, sometimes radiating extraordinary light, sometimes uttering strange sayings. This continued for 10 years, and then it stopped. The meditation master told his disciples, "A celestial demon had been coming here to bother me, but no matter what appearance it created, I dealt with it by not looking or listening. The demon's manifestations had an end, but my not looking and not listening have no end." There it is. Don't be pulled into that stuff. The great Nobel Prize-winning mathematician John Nash was plagued with vivid hallucinations for something like 40 years, 39 years. There was a movie made about this, starring Russell Crowe, and playing this John Nash, where they, in the movie, it was very vivid how they showed the hallucinations, his hallucinations as actual characters. And I think most of us, it took a little while before we realized that wasn't some odd character, in real character there on the screen, but it was his mental pictures of things. Anyway, after all these years, of having these hallucinations, he found that he was no longer troubled by them, and his career became more stable, his family life, and someone or an interviewer asked him, "What did you do that you were able to finally get free of the grip of this terrible hallucinations?" And he said, "I just stopped paying attention to them." That's all we need, is the ability, when these makyo come to us, the ability to not, to redirect our attention, to not let our attention languish on these, in these states, not get drawn into them, but keep returning the attention to the practice, whatever practice we're working on. And then they actually might be there to some extent, sort of flitting around in the mind, but they won't be a problem. It's by giving our attention to these things that they become a problem. I think for a lot of us, we have to go through this a few times, or more than a few times, before we learn through experience that we just don't want to abide in those states. And then they're no longer a problem. There is a learning curve to this. We like to say in Zen that Zen isn't about learning, it's about unlearning. But there is also a kind of learning that comes from trial and error. We learn how to use our attention in a way that is more effective, and not to squander our attention. in peripheral things. But the learning comes from painful mistakes and going sideways and into blind alleys and all kinds of difficult states. Just do one more on demons. One may enter into the sphere of influence of demons as a result of spiritual exercises and experiences. This may be likened to the case of a warrior who is rewarded for achievement in battle, then develops an exaggerated sense of self-importance as a result of that reward, eventually to be punished for presumptuous behavior. When a person takes pride in spiritual practices or experiences, that individual is certain to fall into the sphere of influence of demons. Those who undertake spiritual practices with wrong ideas or develop wrong views in the course of practice, and those who become conceited and oppose the doctrines or methods of others, enter states of mind and modes of being that may be referred to as hell, hellish states. So the key thing here is, I think the most important thing is to beware of becoming proud of one's abilities or achievements in meditation. And the pride can be very subtle. We don't necessarily see it. We have to be vigilant and not let that. That too is another pitfall, to slip into pride or self-satisfaction. We get little glimpses of this when we have a good run of absorption, say a good afternoon or evening or just a single round or half a round of deep quiet sitting can leave us a little bit puffed up and feeling like we're pretty swell, and then that right there we've gone somewhere else, and we have to reel it in and get back to the matter at hand. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.